Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews, and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Hey everyone, my guest today is the Academy Award-nominated actress Uma Thurman. Uma became an international movie star playing Mia Wallace in Pulp Fiction, but her illustrious film career includes roles in Nymphomaniac, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, Dangerous Liaison, Henry and June, Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2, Sweet and Lowdown, Prime, The Producers, and more recently, The War with Grandpa, The House That Jack Built, and The Brits Are Coming. On television, she has starred in Hysterical Blindness, for which she won a Golden Globe Award, Smash, The Slap, and Imposters. She was last seen on the New York stage in the Classic Stage Company production of The Misanthrope. She is now making her Broadway debut in The Parisian Woman. She has been nominated or won every award possible on the planet for her remarkable work. She is a passionate activist for human rights. She is the daughter of the world-famous Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman. She's the mother of three. She lives in New York City. And I'm really thrilled that Uma Thurman is on my podcast today.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon.
What time is it? It's hard to say.
Well, when you're in the theater, you do lose track of time.
You're working the night shift.
You work the night shift. You work 7 days a week. In fact, this week, 8 days a week.
Because, listeners, I'm not sure when this is going to present itself to you, but Uma is opening this week in her Broadway debut. I was so fortunate to see you in The Parisian Woman. And I have to say, as someone who has been in many Broadway plays myself, I literally became my mother during the play and looked at Judy Kuhn, who was my guest, and I said, how did she learn all those lines? Like, I literally felt like someone who has never done this before, because it is an extraordinarily powerful and daunting role to take on. And you do it magnificently, but I want to go back a little bit in time.
Sure.
To little Uma and kind of get a sense of when you began to fall in love with the performing arts that brings you today to the Broadway stage.
Well, from the time I was very, very little, you know, I for different reasons in my family, I went to a few different schools. So I was a new kid quite a few times. And
it's like being an army brat.
It was kind of like being an academic army brat. And I guess also because I grew so tall so early, I was, you know, it took me a long time to kind of settle into my body. So I wasn't very athletic. And I think I'm undiagnosed because of, you know, I'm born 1970. You know, I didn't read right away when other kids read. So memorization, the theater, whatever it was, the school play, was a place that I just simply navigated towards. And I think a lot of actors share parts of that. But that was, you know, on the stage being something else, the Christmas tree, I don't know, the family dog. I'm joking. I don't remember what little roles I played in school. But
a lot of people wanted to play the Christmas tree and the family dog, and you got the both parts.
Right. So that was from the beginning, you know, and I also think that, you know, if she can see it, she can be it. That whole study and research about women is true. My father's mother, so my paternal grandmother, was, who died when I was three, was a stage actress.
Was she in New York?
She was in New York. Her name was Elizabeth Ferrer, and she did a lot of off-Broadway and stuff, and also raised three children herself. So I think she probably had her hands full. But
you're doing the same thing.
Yes, in a way. But, you know, I think somehow that being part of my family history probably opened up the possibility to me that this is something I could dream to do.
And you had brothers.
Yes. I have a half-sister who's older than me, who's the oldest child of my father's. And then I have three brothers that I, you know, really grew up in a
And where are you in the family?
I'm the exact middle of those five.
I've had a lot of people come on the show who are the children of people who were incredibly successful in their chosen field. Mm-hmm. And your father is not famous for being an actor, but your father was like, and maybe he has grown in his notoriety for being a Buddhist scholar as you've grown also, or maybe you were aware early on that your father was a powerful person in his community.
He was always a very powerful person and, you know, a great intellectual force. And a very, you know, committed philosophical and spiritual man.
And were you as a family, were you people who meditated together? Or
no.
Was it a more solitary thing for him?
Both my parents are Buddhist. But I remember when I was younger that, I guess because they were both raised, you know, in different Christian forms, that they felt strongly that, you know, that was a sort of something that you chose for yourself. And, you know, versus the religion that was imposed on them when they grew up. And
right.
They chose another for themselves as adults. So it was very much around us. And, you know, we would go on sabbatical with him to India when I was younger, twice, once when I was a baby, once when I was 9, 10 years old. So we were, there was a lot of exposure and so on. But we weren't asked to practice religion with them.
Well, it's funny because now, you know, you ask any kid growing up things like mindfulness or meditation or awareness or even Buddhism are words that they'd be really familiar with. I mean, they teach mindfulness in schools now, right? If you're lucky.
I should go take a class.
You should. I feel like maybe you could teach a class. But I wonder if when you were growing up, it was much more exotic to be a part
completely.
Of this family. And if were you embarrassed? Were you excited?
Oh, I wanted to go to church. I remember when I was very little begging my mother to take me to church,
right.
To be sort of like everyone else. And I think she did, at least one occasion. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's only very brave and rare children, individual children, are happy to be set aside
mm-hmm.
from
whatever the norm is.
The norm is, yeah. It's not necessarily like the easiest, you know, thing to live on the fringe when you're, you know, particularly like in grade school.
Yeah, not great. Not great.
Not, and we all had, you know, we all have like either Sanskrit or, you know, Tibetan or whatever. All of our names are, you know, for white American kids, we all were carrying, you know, you couldn't get past hello without it
right.
there being a question about who you were.
Because it was exotic.
My name is, and okay, yeah, it's over
already.
For you.
Or just beginning. What does Uma mean?
Well, Uma is an incarnation of Parvati. So the name technically supposedly means may she not suffer.
Ooh. Thanks.
It was a nice. It was a nice thought.
They did their best.
Everybody does.
We
right?
all do our best. We know as a parent, we're just trying.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Trying to
well,
give them a leg up.
They had the good wishes for me from the onset there. So yeah, she's a whole story. She's the mother of Ganesha, who's the great elephant god that, you know, is the remover of obstacles. Probably one of my favorite of the symbolic gods.
But I just imagine you in like third grade, like explaining that.
Yeah.
Be like, we know what an elephant is.
Well, apparently my mother tells a funny story. I was around eight or so. I think it was so difficult for me that whatever classes I would go to, like ballet or this or that, I would simply tell the teacher that I had another name. And
like would, Lisa?
Yeah.
Or something? Yeah.
What was this? You know, Charlie's Angels, like Kelly.
Totally.
Diana. And one of my mother's friends actually came to a dance performance. I don't know why my parents couldn't be there. But, you know, she witnessed all the little girls in their ballet leotards sitting in a circle and about to begin the little performance or class or whatever. And the teacher said, Diana, would you close the door? And I just jumped right up and I closed the door.
Pirouetted back.
And pirouetted back in my moments of happiness. But, yeah, so I guess I started being other people early on.
You know, I just want to make sure that my facts are right, because I've spent a lot of time on the internet with you these last few days trying mm-hmm. to kind of figure out a little bit of the arc of your story. And it sounded like you came to New York really young.
Yes, I came to New York we used to visit New York from Massachusetts, where I grew up.
And was your dad's family still here?
Both my father's parents died his father died when he was young. And his mother died when I was a child. A young, you know, toddler. And my mother's also died early, so I didn't grow up with grandparents.
Or cousins, or?
Not really. I have one cousin who I've gotten to know best.
But would you come see theater when you came, or was that a part of, like, the family trip when you would come to the city?
No, we didn't go to the theater much. I did see some theater at Amherst College as a faculty brat there. I remember the stage there. And I was also taken to Indian music concerts and all kinds of things. So I saw some performing arts as a young person, but they were quite heavily, you know, into their academic mission, not into so much like, you know,
but that
fun.
Must have been incredibly intense to have parents who, as you just stated, their mission was academic, and to feel like you were struggling with things that were very simple for other kids, like reading, or you perceived as easier for other kids. I'm sure that was really intense.
It was intense. When I really put my mind back to it, I mean, I do think I'm pretty sure that I didn't really read a word book by myself until I was like nine. You know, I remember doing it. It was so exciting. I was going to school in Smith College Campus School at the time in Northampton.
And something connected.
But yeah, it just sort of eventually, dyslexics aren't incapable of reading.
Right.
It just takes them a lot longer.
Right. But you had nobody guiding you or kind of helping you understand.
At that time, they didn't really have the diagnostic awareness and skills. Although I do remember being taken aside and specially tested when I was like in very, very early, maybe first or second grade. And I think actually my mother saved me by telling me the results, because I wasn't even getting that I didn't I was in denial, or I was a kid, understanding about why, you know, there'd be four groups of kids in the study groups, and I'd be in like this group that like, really wasn't doing very much at all. And wasn't quite sure why, because my relationship to words was very strong,
mm-hmm.
but my relationships to these squiggles on the paper was not very strong.
Right. There was a disconnect.
There was a big disconnect. But she did me this great favor, though, because they did test me in those early days. And she told me that in certain logistic ways, like certain types of thinking, logics, strategy, I don't even remember what the terminologies were, that I was very, very advanced. And not that I feel advanced right now. I didn't, you know, even go to college. But being told I was smart in any way was really helpful.
So when you say you remember suddenly the squiggly lines becoming words that you could read, do you think that you figured out whatever the puzzle was as a dyslexic? Or why do you think that happened? Do you know?
I mean, honestly, there's scientific information about that now.
Yeah.
And there's different theories. And I'm sure there's even more advanced since the last time I looked into it, which was about 10 or 15 years. But I was quite astonished when I learned about modern understanding of dyslexia. And in fact, it was only then that I was actually 100% sure, oh, that's what it was. One of my children was dyslexic. And
so you're looking into it because
I discovered
a parent at that point.
Yeah, as a parent, I was taking the steps to try to understand how to help my child. And through that process, you know, in a very privileged way, you know, good doctors and stuff. As I answered these questions and so on, I was like, oh, that's what it was. My youngest brother to me, I think, who's 8 years younger, when he was in school, they did know. And he received an extraordinary amount of extra support for that because they knew how to do it then,
right,
8 years later.
So when you came to New York, how did that happen? As a young person, what brought you?
Well, I wanted to go to New York, and I don't know how I had the gumption to think that I would be able to be an actress. I came to New York with a girlfriend for summer break. And
how old are you at this time?
15, I think, 15.
Okay.
And then my mom came, and she took me around to, you know, to meet some different agents because I thought I could do a little bit of modeling just because I was tall.
Had you done that before at
no,
all?
No, no, never.
Not one bit.
And it didn't last very long because I wasn't exactly like, you know, the right type. Just tall. That was the only thing I had going. But I was very fortunate. I actually met a man named Alan Mandel. And he had a modeling agency, but he was starting an acting agency. So his modeling agency was called Click, and his acting agency was called Flick. And when he met me, very clever man.
Yeah.
He still works in the industry, he's a manager. So when he met me, he sat this 15-year-old, and I'm sure many 15-year-olds were put in front of him, and he said, so you want to be a model? I said, no, I want to be an actress, but I need to figure out how to get going. And he said, oh, that's good, because I want to represent actresses.
Then he moved from the Click to the Flick desk. Come with me.
Pretty quickly. What actually happened, I stayed in New York that summer.
With this friend's family?
Yes, I stayed in a friend's apartment, and they went on holiday at one point, and I rented a room for like a month.
By yourself?
Yes, there was another renter in the apartment, very nice guy. He was a law student. But anyway, they let me stay there, and through Alan, he found me an acting teacher, and I started to take acting lessons. And then I went back to boarding school, and I got the lead role in the play, which for a sophomore was really good. At that point, I could read very well.
Yes.
And was in love with the English language.
That's awesome.
And
do you remember what the play was?
Yes, of course. It was The Crucible. So I got the role of Abigail, which was a real coup. And then they drove up from New York to see me in it. And at that point, they said, well, if you come back to New York again, if your parents will let you, we'll start sending you on auditions and all that. And I think I had my first role within a few months.
So you left high school.
I transferred to professional children's
school.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And did you live in that room again in your friend's
apartment? No, no. My mom helped me find a small studio apartment next to PCS, which was the professional children's school. So then I had my own apartment.
I'm harping on this because I have a daughter. You have a, how old is your daughter?
She's 19.
Okay, so my daughter is 14. She just started ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also like a
I have a little daughter too, by the way.
Yes, but she's not on her own yet
acting in a studio. Five.
But just like really taking in, sometimes it's hard to kind of place something, the reality of something, but really imagining like my daughter next summer coming to New York by herself.
Well, my mother would say that I was very independent.
That's what she would say.
And she was right.
And she was right.
Everyone does the best they can.
Exactly.
You know? And both my parents, you know, had a lot of freedom and individuality when they were, you know, inordinately young.
Mm-hmm.
My mother herself left Sweden, I think, when she was 15 or 16 by herself.
But you were kind of parenting yourself for the last few years of your teens.
You could say that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
in
the memoir.
But I'm very close with my parents, and, you know, but that is true.
So you begin. And it's kind of extraordinary to think about it. I've had, like, Ben Platt and Lucas Hedges and these very young actors who are in, I don't know, 19, early 20s, and sort of what it is to deal with the fame that comes to people now and in the world of social media and sort of all the ways in which it's very different for these young actors coming up.
I can't even imagine the difference, you know. Like, my daughter is turning into a rapidly rising star at 19, and to see what, you know, how they go about it now, young actors, the way they self-tape themselves and, you know, they pick their own the best take to send, you know, that is all so incredible. Like, you know, that is just, I think it's going to change probably acting a lot, but.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the world was so different when I was younger. And I mean, I even went through a big phase in my 20s where I didn't even watch the films that I made very often because I didn't know if it was constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be extremely process-based and not self-conscious. And so I didn't, you know, I didn't really watch dailies. You weren't even allowed to, a lot of directors didn't even allow you to watch what we called, I'm sure your listeners are perfectly versed in all this terminology because of your show, but, you know, the dailies is the showing of the footage. A lot of directors wouldn't even, you know, allow or encourage the actors to review the material.
Right, but now they're standing there and there's playback right away and it's really hard to avoid it even if you
it's
don't want to see
world.
Yourself.
It's just a different world. And so sort of learning acting from the inside out without seeing what it looks like. It's just such a different journey. I mean, no wonder she's such a better actress than I was when I was her age. She really knows what she sees what she's doing.
Right.
It's kind of funny in a way. I don't know. I like to put my my hopes on the side of positive when it comes to change.
Was there any part of you that wanted her to wait
of
to
course.
Begin? And so she won. She won the battle too.
She did, and then she's being proven right. So that's all I want.
So you were working in your teens. What was the first role that you got?
The first role I got was in a tiny independent film that was called Rose by Any Other Name. And it was pretty quickly. And it was like, I can't remember if it was like a $50,000 budget. It was even then, it was a real shoestring production, which in a way was kind of great. I mean, certainly I was had no idea what I was doing, but I was also learning how to do my own continuity and my own makeup and putting together my own costumes from my own wardrobe. And,
sure.
So in a way, like, it was kind of an interesting start to make a small independent film like that.
So between a Rose by Any Other...
Well, they renamed it Kiss Daddy Goodnight because it sounded more salacious.
Great.
But it was originally called A Rose by Any Other Name.
So between Kiss Daddy Goodnight and Pulp Fiction.
Yes. Well, between that, I think the second I did a kind of Brat Pack movie of the time called Johnny Be Good with Robert Downey Jr. and Anthony Michael Hall. And
did you start collecting a community of your own of acting friends or through class or through these films? Did you feel like, okay, now I have my friend group?
Not really. Not because I wouldn't have wanted to, but, you know, I mean, this is, I'm totally proud of my age. The truth is, this is in it. I mean, we didn't have cell phones. So you just, you know, you'd go to, you know, I turned 18. So just chronologically, after the Brat Pack movie, I met Terry Gilliam. And then, you know, while auditioning for all kinds of things that I didn't get. And then Terry Gilliam cast me in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. And so I was 17 years old when I went off to Italy for like 6 months.
Wow.
By myself, mostly. And, but it was that job, because I think I was kind of playing hooky. In a way, you know, even though I was enrolled and stuff and sending in my papers, my father would often help me type them out when I'd go home for a holiday. That job in Cinecittà with John Neville and Jonathan Pryce and the young Sarah Pauly, who was just a baby, and Alison Steadman and, you know, the great English and
what a great troupe.
Incredible troupe. And Terry Gilliam, who was at the time probably like one of my favorite directors of films that I'd seen so far in my life at that point. That was like the pivotal time where I looked out at this, what this kind of auteur-based cinema was, and I realized that's what I wanted to do.
And when you look back to how Terry directed, what are some of the things that come to mind about what made him so special to work with, what makes his film so magical?
He's simply has a sort of like, I mean, he's a magical, visionary artist, you know? I mean, he really is an artist. I mean, I think there's great directing and there's all different kinds of directing. In fact, that's one of the things I find fascinating with directors. But, I mean, Terry Gilliam is sort of, you know, he started off as an animator or whatever you call it, whatever that is. but he's truly like, is a visionary. And film is his medium.
Right. And he's just creating all these elaborate, gorgeous pictures as well as
building
inhabiting
worlds.
The worlds with
world,
humans.
He's a yeah. world builder, yes.
So that was a great experience to begin on with someone like that.
It was really quite something to be exposed to. And I was a big fan of Brazil and, you know, and some of his other work. And, of course, having three brothers, the Python stuff I was very familiar with.
Right.
I don't know why, but I feel like as a kid that was more a boy thing, but I liked it.
So did you audition for Pulp Fiction?
Yes.
I assume you didn't know him, Quentin Tarantino, before you did that film.
I didn't. And it started out, apparently, I don't think he really knew who I was other than maybe that girl that was in, because then I'd already done Les Liaisons Dangereuses, mm-hmm. and I'd also done a film with John Borman called Where the Heart Is.
So there was a young rising star in his orbit that he'd heard of and maybe seen.
I'm pretty sure he told me that he didn't want to meet me and that my agent the time, fine, he didn't want to meet me and that I think Jay Maloney, who was my agent at Creative Artists at the time, he somehow just kind of like hoodwinked it where he just sort of sent a message to Quentin that the meeting was set. and, you know, I'd be at the Ivy at 8 o'clock and Quentin was like, oh, well, I'd have to check that with Quentin, but I'm pretty sure I remember correctly. And we sat down and just started talking and the conversation has gone on and off, but continued for some decades.
And had you read the script yet when you met him?
I'm trying to remember. I certainly knew what the part was, but I know I was unprepared for the meeting, so I was doing everything I could do to talk about life and cinema without really having to be pressed on content or delivery.
Always, kids at home, always a smart tactic. Right. Look over here. Oh, yeah, nothing to see here.
or I guess as John Oliver just recently coined the term, or if he coined it, whataboutism.
Exactly.
Yes, the script is interesting, but what about?
By the way, have you had the clams? They're delicious. I feel like it's no secret that that character has become really an iconic film character. And her look, you know, once you become like a Halloween costume, like, you know, there is something that has resonated.
Well, I take a lot of pride in that because my fingerprints are very much on creating that. Like, Quentin wanted me to be blonde. And I was like, no, I don't want her to be blonde. I want her to like have this sort of Louise Brooksy kind of hair and even the flare to the pant. I mean, we get down to the details, right? When you start to like get into that sort of stuff. But we always actually really worked very well together with creating pictures.
So you're in your early 20s at that point?
Yeah, I'm trying to, I think the timeline is, I think we shot that in 92.
So you're still like a baby.
Pretty
in terms
much.
Of, right? And yet you had this clarity. This character looks like this. I feel like she would sound like this.
Everything, her dark mouth, her dark nails. Although, because, I mean, Quentin's a guy. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, he's not going to, like, argue with me about nail polish.
Probably didn't care.
I think he just liked it. It's like, yeah, okay.
That seems good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Okay. That sounds good.
Obviously, the look of that character and the takeaway for anyone, even if you have Alzheimer's, I feel like I will have Alzheimer's and remember the dancing scene with John Travolta. Like, that will be one of my memories in life.
Me too.
Yeah?
You know, I mean, that was actually, I mean, going off of my sort of feeling of awkwardness that I did have, like, I was terrified of the dance scene. I was like, I can't dance. Even though I did dance, like dance classes when I was younger.
Diana did close the door in an early ballet class.
Diana did.
but now Uma was faced
with
this.
But I didn't like to dance in front of people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm tall. I was like uncomfortable. And it was John Travolta.
Yes.
Okay.
And I went his reputation preceded him.
I went to see Saturday Night Fever when I was a kid. I remember sneaking into the movie theater with my brother. So, you know, I was really terrified. And actually, that was it was a great moment in my, just aside from what
happened,
the results were, In my life and process, like, I didn't want to stop dancing once I started.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
That was the beginning of that. So
yeah. Was that a choreographed rehearsal, or is that something that was pretty improvised?
Well, Quentin had two references. One was an Aristocats reference, the animated Aristocats, and the other was from a Godard film.
By the way, you'll never hear that sentence again. The Aristocats, a Godard film.
That's what's so great about him. But, and then, I mean, I remember then we were just, I think we were in, the, we all had very little grubby trailers. You know, that film wasn't a big, huge budget movie.
Right.
And we were in maybe John's trailer, I don't know. And, you know, John, of course, and Quentin, they all knew the names of those, like, 50s dances, I guess, right? You know, the Batman, the Swim, the this, the that. Basically, like, they just sort of showed me, like, oh, we're going to do, let's do this and let's do that. And, of course, the twist was going to be involved. And so there was just, and then we decided there was just a little lineup. Okay, we'll both do this, and then you do the Swim, and I'll do the Swim, and you do the Batman, and I'll do the Batman, and you know, and then we just did it.
And music was really playing.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's a very famous story, but I think it's, I mean, that Quentin did some of the handheld camera work himself, but he got so into dancing that the camera was dancing as well as the
and
dancers.
And when we see the final cut, is that like that, or did they figure out how to, like...
I don't know. No, just... I think there was some other footage taken, but
that could work.
I don't know. Have to ask him.
That's cool. So that changes everything. Then you're like in a stunning yellow dress at Cannes, and it's beginning, right? Like this idea of my life is not exactly my own anymore. I mean, even without Snapchat or Twitter and all that stuff, you became
that started
a very
earlier though.
You were recognizable.
That started really with Liaison. I was slightly recognizable before Liaison. But people couldn't quite get my name right. But the first time I was ever asked for my autograph, these two young girls came over all excited, and they said, are you Uni Thirsty?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, one love, man. I like this. I guess I'm Uni Thirsty.
From now on.
From now on. And I don't know if I signed Uni Thirsty, but...
I hope so.
Anyway, so that started then to get... I was already dealing with quite a lot of that from 17, 18.
For someone who, it sounds like, was shy and was looking for a career that sort of allowed you to embody all these other people, how was that for you and how is that for you?
Well, what was difficult was, you know, I knew that, well, you know, pigeonholing was maybe worse then than it is today, you know, as far as like, you know, color by number, that's who you are and that's all you're going to get to be. And I was very, very aware of it. And especially as a young woman who would be considered, you know, no one would care about whether I could act or not.
Mm.
And probably not necessarily cast me in roles where there'd be much acting to do. And I didn't want to let that happen to me. So I turned down lots of very big ticket items to be like a young siren. Because I knew that I'd just be done for. It's like,
right.
Okay, here's a huge movie and they're offering you all this money, but, you know, but don't do that. Go do this and don't get paid. You know what I mean? Keep trying to fish for the fish you want, not for the fish you get.
And is the black wig and sort of the Louise Brooks, I mean, you were able to put a new stamp on something completely then, right? Like that's the opposite of the sort of Botticelli girl coming out of
a clamshell. That's one of the reasons that really kick-started my career and...
In another way.
I swear to God, I just didn't look like that girl. I was another person that people like actually looked at like, oh... You know, someone's an actress.
So how do you hold on to yourself when a lot of strangers think they know you?
Well, it's too bad more of them don't. Far less lonely.
You want to know? You want an autograph? Let me spend 20 minutes with you really telling you about me. Could you imagine?
Come home with me so I don't have to sit alone in the kitchen.
Oh.
Just kidding.
Yes.
Kind of.
You never have to leave this booth. You can go from podcast to theater back to the booth.
It sounds great, but yeah. I think people would get really bored.
Maybe. I can't imagine that at all.
I don't know. I mean, I remember... I don't know. I don't want to actually quote it wrongly, but two famous actors, very, very famous actors, were making a legendary huge film once. And one of them said to the other, "You've been famous 3 times longer than you were ever a human being. How do you know anything at all about what life is like for other people?" You know, I would say who those two actors are, but I don't want to mess up the story at all. I like my details to be tight.
I appreciate
but,
that.
But, I started as a teenager. And I think, first of all, there's no point in me weighing in what was good or bad about it because it's just what it was. And in a way, what I'm most grateful for is that, you know, here I am decades later, and I do love what I do. I love to act. I mean, I really get a great pleasure out of it. Obviously, some of the side effects, you know, your career, its status, your struggle to kind of get the kind of work you want, you know, and then everything else life does to you, you know. Of course, that stuff is challenging, but I do love what I do. So I feel grateful that I've had time to practice.
I think that's a perfect way to lead up to this play that you decided to do. How exciting to do this for decades and get to do something new, which is to make a debut, mm-hmm. is an exciting thing as a grown-up person.
It's just so wonderful. I've enjoyed it. I mean, it's the most hard work I've done in quite a while.
I imagine you've been offered other plays in...
Not really, no. No. The Misanthrope wasn't exceptionally well received, although it was in rhyming couplets. I mean, I couldn't have picked something more difficult.
Right.
But I just wanted to try, you know. And also, as a new mother at the time. I had my eldest child was just a baby. And so that's all, as you know yourself, that's a very overwhelming moment in your life. Like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, I have this baby. It's full time. It's an enormous responsibility. How do I work? You know, the beginning of that is always a very sensitive time.
And you have a little person now again.
Yes, but she's not an infant.
Right.
I mean, when I did the first play, I was nursing.
Literally. Yeah.
I mean.
And sobbing.
I was nursing.
I remember nursing.
So I'm not nursing, which
Good.
Is a really great
Good.
Thing. But I've enjoyed it so much. I've had this incredible, it's a real gift. I was introduced through my attorney to Pamela McKinnon to take a general meeting.
She's a magnificent theater director.
She's a magnificent human. And she probably could direct other things magnificently, too. She's very gifted. And so we go for a general meeting, and really just because he thought we'd get along, and I just was talking to her about, you know, what her thoughts were about how I could try to approach finding a way to get on the stage again.
You'd been thinking about it.
Oh, yeah, for years.
Always.
There was just no opportunity for me to bat away. You know, I was going to have to figure it out. I had a long time to think about it. So I did have like a dream scenario. I had thought to myself, having seen a lot of different theater work, that a new play would be a good way for me to recommence my approach to taking my work onto the stage and making those adaptations and figuring out, you know, trying to make that mathematical shift.
Do you feel like that's a different approach than film work?
Well, it's kind of exactly the same, except one, you really work in depth with other people in a way that you just never, ever get to.
Right. There's no luxury of that on film.
There is no luxury of that on film. And so many, which is why I think sometimes, a lot of times my work would be better when I had it like someone, a coach or a dialect coach, or when I worked with someone so that I had someone to prepare with.
Sure.
And, you know, it just makes a difference than what you alone in your living room I mean, there are several films that I've done in time, like, you know, I remember back through the history, where people do some sort of reasonable rehearsal of films, but very often, really very little. And I think also as you get older in your career as an actor, you are being cast because you are a professional, so that no one needs to take the time to get you to deliver something that they're going to want.
Right.
So it's like, bring us something. Thank you.
Okay. Can you help me get a running start? I'd really appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know.
But it's true.
It's what it is. So getting back to this real process and really getting to break down character and moments and dynamics between characters in you know, this profoundly psychoanalytic and thoughtful and physical way has been just a true joy, because it's kind of like everything I love about the work, and none of the noise.
And what about this play, The Parisian Woman, specifically made you think, this is the one, I think I can do this, and this is why I want to do this?
Well, at the end of my general meeting with Pam, you know, we had a really nice time, and I said to her, well, you know, if you think of anything that you think maybe would be an interesting piece of material for me to read, or you hear about anything, you have any ideas, or if you need anyone to do a reading or whatever, just let me know, you know. Thank you so much for meeting. And then she said, well, I have something I've been working on with a writer. I'd love you to look at it. And so, you know, X days, minutes, weeks later, I get The Parisian Woman in its then state, which was before the election. So it was kind of the same play and kind of a totally different play.
Mm-hmm.
It was about Washington. It was about all those five characters existed, but they've basically been reborn. Chloe's actions were quite similar.
You're Chloe.
I am Chloe. But when I read it, first of all, I found it incredibly enjoyable and sort of wicked and funny in a very sort of biting way. But she's a very strong character and, you know, passionate, complicated, and confident. And I, you know, it was just like kind of like a no-brainer to me. Like, well, if I had sent a letter to Santa or God saying, could I please get to do a new piece of writing by a writer who I love with an extraordinary director, and in fact, her being female was part of the dream. Not that I have anything against anyone else. I had a feeling that would be really
interesting. A great collaborator.
A great collaborator, especially on such an interesting, complicated, sexual character as this. To be able to see that with another woman, it's just a different thing than trying to communicate about that with a man.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that all men can't do that. I'm not saying that. But I think this is a perfect, it was just my dream. It was a no-brainer. It was like, okay, well, here it is. And then, you know, we went about a kind of long process of preparing to do it, and it's taken several years. And then, of course, the election happened in the middle. The whole play could have just become irrelevant until, of course, Bo Willimon dove in there
and reinvented it a bit.
Reinvented it and made it more relevant.
Were you undaunted by the size of the part and what it would be to learn it and to do it? And how did you learn that part, in all seriousness? How long did you spend working on it?
Well, it changed a lot. We did several readings of it. And of course, the play changed a lot. I was afraid before rehearsal that there was a chance it might change more, because mm-hmm. it is a new play. Mm-hmm. And actually, that is not uncommon.
Right.
Even if it weren't about, you know, modern day, present day Washington, which, as we all know, is apocalyptic. You couldn't cement this role. It's not like it's Miss Julie and those are the mm-hmm. words. So you could learn it 2 years before you plan to do the production.
Right.
If you weren't now too old for the part.
Yes. I'm doing Mrs. Julie, and I'm really excited about that.
Madame Julie.
Exactly. They've just changed it a little bit.
Yeah, just changed the play just a little bit. I mean, that's one of the things that's so fantastic about being an actor is it does require it's good for the brain. You know, the brain is a muscle and it needs to be used and it needs to be treated like the inventive, soft material that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want calcification inside of the skull.
No, I do not. I don't want calcification really in any part of me. I guess as they're super white. Well, it really is. It's a really compelling piece of theater. It also is really interesting to think about, you know, most of us live in a marriage with an understanding of what the rules are in a marriage. And it was very interesting to see, without giving too much away, a couple who live by their own rules. And I admire that.
It's very interesting. In fact, all of the relationships, I mean, as much as there's a lot of humor that is sort of like painfully earned in the audience, just because, you know, about how crazy our political system has gotten, as if we thought it couldn't get crazier. So there's that sort of humor, but there's a serious amount of subtlety and complexity in these human relationships between these five people. Many of them are not conventional, or what we call conventional.
Well, it really is an opportunity for us to get some relief, some comic relief, and a release from the pent-up emotion that we all have as we continue to wake up every morning and see, oh, he's still the president.
One of the things that I find so interesting about the audiences is I have quite a few friends who are pretty good and decent Republicans, good people, and they love the play. Because they're in pain too, you know. It's not like it's not about one-sidedness, you know.
Well, at its best, it's not.
Yeah, at its best, it's not, and it's sort of about our society at the moment, and kind of about the sort of up for grabs nature of what anything means, you know?
Do you feel scared as a public person who has lent your name? I mean, I support Room to Grow, an organization in New York that helps mothers living below a certain economic line. I know, and I get emails from you. You didn't even know you were writing me about things. It's just a wonderful place. It's a store where new mothers who don't have a lot of means can come and really get set up for their new children
without having to pay for anything.
That's right, and it feels like a shopping experience, and it's just filled with dignity. And Room to Grow is a beautiful facility, and it's kind of a remarkable place. It's easy to put one's name to something like that, right? There's no risk involved. Do you get nervous ever of, as a public person and as a famous person, attaching your name to a point of view?
Do I get nervous is the first half of that question. And it could stop right there. Mm-hmm. Of course I get nervous. Mm-hmm. I'm not nervous about the questions that this play investigates. I think if we stop asking questions, if we stop having a kind of human response, you know, that's why, you know, I hug my Republican friends who come to this play, and one of whom said that he felt politely and adequately offended, but really more because he's unhappy with his representation.
Sure.
Versus lack of it. So, you know, I think that America, Constitution, was probably one of the best efforts made by mankind to try to create a fair and decent society. You know, our legal system is supposed to represent the strong, the wealthy, and the less wealthy or poor. You know, this country was designed with ideals that are worth fighting for. They must be fought for against anyone trying to undermine them, because, you know, we had some very good ideas here. They may need to be adapted in different ways, and modern life is changing how things happen, but I think that America the American dream is a dream, but you must keep some dreaming alive to be able to reinvent a good world.
Well, I vote for you. I'm very excited.
Well,
Thurman 2020, please.
I didn't make it past hello.
I just want to ask you before you go, because I feel like you would appear to be someone who others would imagine has a very successful life. And I wonder for you how you would define success for yourself.
That's an intense question. I define success by the plasticity of my brain and the ability to learn, the ability to heal, to love, to forgive, and to struggle. If, you know, those, I'm probably missing, I've only got five fingers up. I should probably have five more, but I think those things, as long as those things are happening in my life, learning, struggling, loving, healing. I don't know, I missed the fifth one. It mustn't have been important.
We'll have it on playback. Uma Thurman, thank you so much for being here today. I'm just so thrilled to have had you. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
It was great.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.